government regulations, which were created to protect employees, are actually hurting them.
Regulation after regulation.
Until the government understands that they have to create an environment suitable for us to keep growing, we're going to stay in this recession a long time.
The federal government has blocked efforts to expand the ride-sharing.
The owners say the restaurant has succumbed to the crush of government regulations.
We have seen an unprecedented explosion of new regulatory activity.
$1.8 trillion. That's how much business
and bus companies to close.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut.
The regulations are...
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep...
Is this really the best we can do?
This is Free Lunch, the podcast of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project. All expressions of opinion on this podcast are those of the speakers.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another Federalist Society Free Lunch podcast call for the Regulatory Transparency Project. Visit the RTP website at regproject.org, regproject.org, to subscribe to our newsletter and to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. My name is Devin Westhill. I'm the director of the RTP and the host of the Free Lunch Podcast. This Free Lunch Podcast is about how the Food and Drug Administration regulates the speech of pharmaceutical and medical device companies, specifically where the FDA limits these companies' ability to share information about so-called off-label uses of their products. Among the questions we'll explore on this topic today are, as a legal matter, is this prohibition on speech permissible under the First Amendment? As a policy matter, is this prohibition mainly good or bad? And, as a practical matter, is the law and policy likely to change in this area anytime soon? Here to help us make sense of all of this is the Executive Vice President of the Goldwater Institute and our Free Lunch Podcast guest, Christina Sandifer. Christina develops policies and litigates cases advancing healthcare freedom, free enterprise, private property rights, free speech, and taxpayer rights. She is also a co-drafter of the Right to Try initiative, now law in over half of the states, which protects terminally ill patients' right to try safe investigational treatments that have been prescribed by their physician but are not yet FDA approved for market. Christina is also an author, a frequent media commentator and speaker, and she has provided expert legal testimony to various legislative committees. I'm very pleased to say that Christina also interviewed for and is featured in RTP's recently released short video on occupational licensing for our fourth branch video series. If you haven't seen it yet, and if you'd like to learn more about Christina, go to regproject.org. Shortly, I'll turn the floor over to Christina. Before I do, I remind everyone that the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy initiatives, and therefore, all expressions of opinion on Free Lunch podcasts are those of our featured speakers. Also, Christina has been very gracious and has agreed to take questions after her remarks, so please be prepared with any questions that you might have prior to the start of the Q&A period. Christina, it's a pleasure to welcome you today as our Free Lunch podcast guest. You have the floor.
Well, thank you so much for having me today, and thanks to everybody who's joining on the call. This is a very important topic and one that that has been around for a while, but I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about in the coming months. And so I appreciate the opportunity to go over it with you. So before I get started, for anybody who's interested in taking more of a deep dive look at this topic, I co-authored a paper with my colleague Naomi Lopez-Bauman at the Goldwater Institute. She's an expert in healthcare policy. I myself am not. I'm just an attorney. But we co-authored this paper on off-label promotion and the prohibitions that the FDA places on off-label promotion and a little bit about what the states are doing. So a lot of the things you're going to hear me mention today are discussed more deeply in that paper, and there's also a lot of citations for the lawyers on the phone that that might be interested in those. You can find that paper on our website at goldwaterinstitute.org. So let's get into the topic now. I want to start out with a story to sort of illustrate what we're talking about here. And this story is about a woman named Laura. This is a true story, and Laura has colorectal cancer. Laura's been through a lot of different treatment options, and all of the conventional treatments that are out there have failed to be successful for her. Now, there is an FDA-approved treatment out there. It's for a different type of cancer, but her doctors believe that it actually might work for her and save her life. And in fact, the people who have developed that particular treatment also agree, based on their studies with the treatment, that it could help Laura. So Laura's all ready to take this treatment, But unfortunately, her insurance carrier has denied coverage for that treatment. Why? Well, because when they look at the basic facts, Laura has colorectal cancer. This treatment isn't FDA approved for colorectal cancer. So to the insurance company, it doesn't make sense for her to take that treatment and for the insurance company to cover the treatment. Now, of course, based on the facts that I gave you, we can understand why this treatment would be good for Laura. And of course, if the insurance company might have known that the manufacturer had reason to believe that the treatment would work for Laura, had seen some of the data and information about this treatment, then the insurance company might have granted approval and covered the treatment. But the manufacturer never had an opportunity to share that data and that research and information with the insurance company. And why is that? That's because it's actually illegal to do so. And actually sharing that information with the insurance company could subject the manufacturer to criminal penalties. That's because Laura's treatment would be considered off-label, and that's what we're talking about today. So let's start by discussing what is off-label use. Well, when we talk about off-label use, what we're talking about is a legal prescription, a treatment that is FDA approved, but it's being used for purposes, different patient populations, or maybe in different dosages than the FDA originally approved. So the treatment is approved for one purpose or patient population or in a certain dose, and the doctor is using that treatment for a different purpose, different patients or different dosages. Now, this is perfectly lawful practice, and in fact, off-label use is really common. About 1 in 5 of all prescriptions are prescribed off-label, and it's especially common in oncology. About 30% of the most popular cancer treatments out there are prescribed off-label, and when surveyed, almost every oncologist has said that off-label use is important to their practice. In fact, I recently had a prescription off-label. Many of you in the call probably have too. I had undergone a surgery and I was having a hard time sleeping. And the doctor said, well, I'm going to prescribe you a sleep medication to help you sleep. And what it was a muscle relaxant. And when I went to pick it up, the pharmacist said, okay, well, we need to talk about this drug here. I want to let you know that this will make your muscles feel better and it'll take away the pain, but don't take it during the day because it'll knock you right out. And you won't be able to drive or function during the day. So again, the purpose, the FDA-approved purpose of that medicine was a muscle relaxant, and the pharmacist was letting me know that a side effect was that it would put me to sleep. Of course, the whole reason my doctor prescribed the medicine was to help me sleep. So again, very common off-label treatments, perfectly legal. And the reason that we have off-label treatments and the reason that they are lawful is because the current process, FDA process for approving drugs for market is incredibly cumbersome. It's very lengthy. It can take 15 years in some cases, and it can take billions of dollars. And so for a company to go through that very lengthy process in order to have their treatment tested, not just for safety, but also for efficacy and for a particular purpose and dosage, it wouldn't make sense to make that company go all the way back through the process and take all of those years and spend all of those dollars on getting that treatment FDA approved for something that might be just a slightly different use or a slightly different patient population. If that were the case, companies would not be able to afford or would have no incentive to put their drugs through the process in the first place, and patients would never get the treatments that they need. So the FDA itself, in allowing off-label treatment, is recognizing that it makes sense once a drug is deemed safe and once it's being used for particular purposes that doctors using their medical judgment can prescribe these treatments for other uses. But here's the problem. So again, while these treatments are perfectly legal and while prescribing these treatments for an off-label use is perfectly legal, federal law often prohibits the sharing of truthful, not misleading information between a pharmaceutical manufacturer and a provider, or between a pharmaceutical manufacturer and an insurance company, even if that treatment is a commonly used one, like some of the treatments that we were just talking about. So this is odd for a couple of reasons. One, the manufacturer, of course, is oftentimes the party with the most information about the drug's uses and also the risks and side effects. So as the manufacturer continues to study and have data about their treatments, it would make sense that the manufacturer would be the party that would share that information with doctors and insurance companies, and yet they're the ones that are barred from talking about that information. It's also an odd situation for attorneys because when we look at free speech law, typically speech is not seen itself, with some exceptions, of course, as being harmful, and we usually protect speech to a greater degree than we protect conduct. But of course here, this is an odd situation where that is flipped. We're protecting conduct, we're allowing doctors to prescribe treatments off-label, more so than the speech. We're banning the speech itself. And of course, this is something that I refer to as a gag rule. I think it's exactly what it is. And this has all sorts of really negative implications for the parties involved. As I mentioned, companies can actually face criminal penalties for the crime of misbranding just for speaking the truth or sharing truthful information. And we'll talk a little bit more about that specific crime later. Doctors also are left in the dark because of this prohibition. Oftentimes, they're unaware that off-label treatments exist. For example, in Laura's case from earlier, a doctor might be unaware that there are other cancer treatments out there that could treat colorectal cancer. Or if doctors are aware of the treatment, they might not have the most up-to-date information about side effects, about dosage, and those types of things. So you're leaving doctors in the dark. And then, of course, as in Laura's situation, payers might be unwilling to cover off-label treatments, even though if they knew a little bit more about these treatments, they might be willing to cover them because it would be win-win for everybody. And finally, when you know, at the end of the day, it's patients who are really harmed by these prohibitions, right? Because doctors and payers and companies aren't able to provide the treatments that these patients want and need because they don't have information. So because this is a Federalist Society call, the first question here is again, you know, going back to the First Amendment and protections for free speech. Our Constitution protects freedom of speech. And if you look at the First Amendment, it really makes no distinction between different kinds of speech, right? The First Amendment protects the freedom of speech. And yet, over the years, particularly in the Progressive and New Deal era, courts have started drawing distinctions between commercial and non-commercial speech. And that could be an entire teleforum in itself, and in fact, it has been the subject of many Federalist Society podcasts. It's a very strange thing to divide speech between commercial and non-commercial, but nevertheless, we do have that distinction in the law, and basically, commercial speech gets lesser protection. Courts have been less willing to protect a company's right, say, to speak, for a financial motive than they have political speech or speech like that, expressive speech. Now, this commercial-non-commercial distinction is troubling, and it's really, I think, at the root of what's going on here with this FDA prohibition on off-label speech. In principle, it's troubling because, of course, dividing speech between commercial and non-commercial is content-based, right? That's the government making a judgment on what speech it's going to protect and what speech it's going to protect to a lesser degree based on the content of the speech, based on what the speech says or who's the speaker. And, of course, that's frowned upon. The Supreme Court has said that that's not okay under the Constitution. But of course, there's also practical implications here. Where do we draw the line between the motivation of, you know, what's commercial and what's non-commercial? It's a very difficult thing to do. For example, newspapers. Say the editorial board of a newspaper writes an opinion piece about a particular politician. Is that speech political and thus entitled to the top protection under free speech law, or is it commercial? Because, of course, the newspaper wants to sell papers. They're writing what they're writing in order to get a profit. And so then if it's commercial speech, it would be entitled to lesser protection. It's really difficult to draw those lines. And that's why, again, we get these oddities in the law where we have perfectly truthful, lawful speech that's being cracked down on. Nevertheless, though, recent cases before the Supreme Court have confirmed that commercial speech, even if it's given lesser protections, it still is protected speech. This has happened in the area of medicine. Back in 2011, the United States Supreme Court struck down a Vermont law that prohibited the use of information relating to doctors' prescribing practices for commercial use. there was a commercial motivation there, and the Supreme Court nevertheless said that it was okay, that speech rather was protected. And then just recently, a couple of years ago, a case that comes out of my backyard here in Arizona, Reed versus Town of Gilbert, the Supreme Court struck down an Arizona ordinance that imposed different restrictions on signs based on whether or not the speech was political, commercial, or religious. And again, the court there said that the government can't make distinctions on speech based on the content of that speech. So we do have some good case law recently reconfirming that commercial speech is a protected form of speech. So, and in fact, you know, back to the off-label speech, there are very few courts that have heard challenges to these off-label speech bans, but the courts that have considered them have all been pretty protective of off-label speech. There's some pretty decent decisions out there. And so it sort of raises the question, why decades later has this prohibition on truthful, not misleading off-label speech persisted? And why is there so much uncertainty out there that has really had quite a chilling effect on the pharmaceutical industry, which again makes it difficult for doctors to treat patients and for patients to get treatment? Well, I think it would be helpful to go through just briefly some of the major cases over the last couple of decades or so, because you'll see a really disturbing pattern of the FDA taking steps that avoid any sort of meaningful precedent in this area. So in other words, every time the FDA gets into legal trouble for gagging the speech rights of pharmaceutical manufacturers, they do things that stop us from getting any kind of guidance from the court, and so these regulations persist. So the first one is back in 2000, the D.C. Circuit struck down FDA guidelines that regulated information that drug companies could provide for use in things like textbooks or other educational materials. And these guidelines also limited companies' abilities to sponsor continuing medical education courses. So companies, again, would have good information about medicines and about treatments that they were developing, and they'd have up-to-date information, and they would want to share that information either in textbooks or in classes that were educational that doctors have to take in order to stay up on their medical education. They'd want to share that information with medical professionals. This was common practice, but FDA guidelines at the time made this unlawful based on, again, this prohibition on off-label speech. And so there was a lawsuit. It went up to the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit struck down those guidelines. And what the FDA did is it took steps to moot the case. It, instead of allowing that case to go forward and instead of appealing or petitioning to the United States Supreme Court to rehear that case since the FDA lost, the FDA turned around and said, you know, actually, we're going to admit that those guidelines that we issued actually didn't prohibit off-label promotion in those particular circumstances. And it would be perfectly fine for drug companies under those circumstances to provide that information. So, again, a very narrow admission of the FDA allowing that information out there. And in legal terms, this has the effect of mooting the case. The facts have changed. The FDA is no longer stopping that speech in that particular under those particular circumstances. And so no need to take the case up to the United States Supreme Court. But, of course, that means the U.S. Supreme Court never gets to hear the case and offer guidance for the entire country to have in this area. So then about a little over a decade later, we see a conviction of a pharmaceutical sales representative who was going out and promoting off-label uses of a particular drug. And the FDA brought criminal charges against this pharmaceutical representative, again, because he was out there sharing information about off-label uses. And that case went up to the Second Circuit. And the Second Circuit overturned that conviction. And this is a really important decision. This came out in 2012, and this case was called United States versus Coronia. And here the court said, really got to the meat of the matter, the things that we've been talking about so far on this teleforum. The court said, government can't prosecute sales representatives for promoting lawful off-label uses. So in other words, because the conduct is lawful, because doctors are allowed to treat off-label, and because the speech is truthful and it's not misleading, then the speech should be lawful as well. Doesn't make sense, again, to prohibit speech about something that is perfectly legal, especially if the speech itself is truthful and isn't misleading anybody. So essentially, that case was really, really important, and people who were watching this issue at the time thought, well, once and for all, this is going to settle this question and this oddity in the law about prohibiting off-label speech. But again, the FDA took actions that made this case basically irrelevant. In this case, the FDA essentially ignored the ruling. They said that although this seemed to be a real breakthrough for the protection of free speech in medicine, the FDA said that the Coronia decision really wasn't going to affect the way that it did business. It wasn't really going to affect its day-to-day dealings with off-label speech. And here's why. Because the FDA said, you know, instead of prosecuting off-label advertising, so instead of prosecuting people for speaking about off-label uses of treatments, which would be a direct prosecution of speech, and the Second Circuit said that wasn't okay, instead what we're going to do is we're going to use off-label speech as evidence of a crime, evidence of the crime of misbranding. So in other words, we're not directly prosecuting speech, we're just using that speech as evidence of a crime, and we'll convict people that way, because committing a crime is conduct and talking is speech. Well, this is a distinction that only a lawyer could love, because to me, what is branding if not speech? When you brand something, so far as the FDA is concerned, you're talking about or sharing information about a treatment. So it seems to me that this was a very devious way of the FDA basically ignoring a very important decision and guidance from the Second Circuit and openly declaring that they weren't going to follow that decision. So the result of that, of course, is that, again, we're without any sort of guidance as to what the FDA is going to do if companies start promoting treatments off-label. Another really important decision that came down in 2015 was the Amarin decision, Amarin versus FDA, and that got a lot of press because Amarin at the time had a fish oil drug, and it had been FDA approved to treat adults that had severe triglyceride levels, and it had been really effective, and so Amarin was going through the process, again, this lengthy approval process, to seek approval to advertise the drug for use in adults with high triglyceride levels. So in other words, their drug is approved to treat people with one condition, and they wanted to get approval from the FDA to talk about how that drug was effective in treating people with a slightly lesser form of that condition. Seems very, very nuanced. But again, the FDA rules here would prohibit Amarin from going out and doing that without getting full approval. Now, Amarin had been running a bunch of trials on this fish oil drug, and the trial results were coming back with statistically significant evidence that the treatment was working for these lower triglyceride levels as well as the approved triglyceride levels. And so Amarin actually went to the FDA and said, look, we've got this information. We're running these tests. While we're waiting for your final approval, we'd love to be able to put these studies out there and show doctors that this fish oil can treat these other conditions as well. And an FDA advisory committee said, no, that marketing would be off-label speech. We would consider that misbranding. So, of course, Amarin, that had a chilling effect on Amarin's ability to go out and share this information with doctors and medical professionals. So Amarin sued the FDA and asked the court to issue a preliminary injunction, essentially telling the FDA that they couldn't go after Amarin and they couldn't charge Amarin with a crime simply for sharing this information that is truthful information and part of the FDA study. And a trial court judge in New York in 2015 issued that preliminary injunction. They agreed with Amarin. The judge said, yes, again, the Coronia decision was pretty clear. The FDA cannot prohibit off-label speech if that speech is truthful and not misleading. So in this preliminary injunction opinion, the court said that the Coronia decision applies to all truthful and not misleading promotional speech, and that this weird distinction the FDA was making between going after somebody for speech and using speech as evidence of a crime really didn't make any sense. Speech is speech. As long as it's truthful and not misleading, we should trust doctors to understand the information that's being given to them from these companies, and the FDA was not allowed to prosecute. So What did the FDA do in this situation? Well, they simply settled the case. Keep in mind, this is a trial court ruling, and it's a preliminary injunction, which means that it's just an initial decision in the case. But the case hadn't gone to trial yet. We hadn't gotten a final ruling out of the trial court. And, of course, it was far away from having any sort of appellate decision that would give guidance beyond just this particular case. And the FDA, apparently not wanting this case to go forward so that their powers would be diminished, settled the case, went to Amarin, essentially allowed them to market their drug the way that they wanted to, and even agreed to sort of fast-track some of their off-label communications in the future, review of those off-label communications, so that if Amarin wanted to go out there and share additional data while they were awaiting approval, the FDA would fast-track that review, essentially buying off Amarin so that the case wouldn't continue, and again, for the rest of the medical community and the legal community, preventing any sort of guidance or final decision in this area. And that's sort of where we are today. Today we have a situation of great uncertainty. The FDA, we know, prohibits off-label speech. They can go after not only pharmaceutical sales representatives, but after the Amarin decision, we've seen the FDA go after companies, go after CEOs, go after vice presidents for communication and marketing in companies, and it leaves companies afraid to be able to go out there and market their products to doctors and share information with doctors and insurance companies. In fact, in 2016, the FDA threatened pharmaceutical representatives and the CEO of company Vascular Solutions. What they were doing is they came up with this really innovative way of treating varicose veins. Before I had gotten into this area and heard about this, I didn't know that varicose veins were not just a cosmetic problem, but actually can cause serious health problems. And the treatment for varicose veins before these innovations was actually quite invasive. Some people on the call might be familiar with this. They would actually have to slice out the vein and take out the bad part, and the recovery was pretty brutal, and it was a big deal. Well, this new treatment, and again, I am not a medical professional. I'm giving you sort of a colloquial overview of what this new treatment would do, but it was essentially a pinprick that would be inserted into the skin that could remove the bad part of the varicose vein, and you could put a Band-Aid over it, and the person could go about their business. So again, this is a great medical innovation for patients. Now, this treatment, there are different kinds of varicose veins, and it depends on where the vein is, if it's close to the skin or if it's farther down in the body. And there are different devices that can treat different varicose veins. The FDA went after Vascular Solutions because the FDA claimed that Vascular Solutions sales reps were telling doctors that their medical devices could treat not only one kind of varicose veins, but all kinds of varicose veins. And again, this was in the FDA's mind an off-label communication. Now, the irony here is that the CEO of Vascular Solutions, Howard Root, said that the FDA had actually approved these treatments for all kinds of varicose veins to begin with. And beyond that, the treatments that the FDA was concerned about were only making up about 0.1% of the total sales of Vascular Solutions. And in this entire back and forth, not one patient was harmed. Not one patient claimed that they were harmed. These treatments were helping people. They were changing people's lives. And pharmaceutical representatives were simply sharing truthful information about these treatments to help doctors help their patients. And yet the FDA charged people at Vascular Solutions with crimes. The CEO was indicted for a felony. And the company, although it was finally vindicated, at the end of the day, the FDA figured out that the company did nothing wrong. Essentially, the company was subjected to a 5-year phishing investigation that cost over $25 million. So, of course, this took a toll on the company. The CEO, Howard Root, actually resigned his position, and he wrote a really fantastic book. Those of you on the call who are interested in a firsthand account of what it's like to battle the FDA when you've done nothing wrong and you're simply just sharing truthful information about a product, that is helping people should pick up that book. It's a very good book, and he went through his experiences with the FDA and fighting the FDA for this many years. Well, again, we have no real legal guidance here, and we see that the FDA is willing to go after companies simply for speaking the truth, and that it could cost companies years and millions of dollars to fight back. And so companies are going to be less and less willing to share this information, and at the end of the day, this is going to harm patients. I don't see the FDA, well, up until recently, I didn't see the FDA changing these tactics at all, and these settlements behind closed doors are really just undermining any kind of guideline here. And this really undermines an important principle of the rule of law. In the United States, we adhere to the rule of law, and the rule of law says that we need clear laws so that people know when they're violating those laws. And that's especially true of speech, because the Supreme Court has said time and time again that if we don't have clear laws that tell people when they can and can't speak ahead of time, it's going to have a chilling effect. People are going to be afraid to speak for fear of punishment, and that's exactly what's happening in the off-label context. But again, it's unlikely that courts will resolve this issue anytime soon, since the FDA continues to moot or settle many of these challenges. And so really what we're going to see is medical innovation is going to be stifled and patients are not going to be helped. Fortunately, though, there is another solution, something that we're seeing a lot of movement in the states in this issue. Now, it might strike some of you on the call as odd, since this is a federal issue. This is an FDA prohibition. And so how exactly do the states have a role? Well, there are two ways that the states have a role. First of all, many state laws, and in fact, perhaps all of the states, have laws that mirror the FDA prohibition, the FDA rules on misbranding. So in other words, if you're out there sharing truthful information about an off-label product, you could be at risk of getting in trouble with the FDA, but also with your state government or state licensing boards. And so the states have a role there. But also, the United States Constitution provides a floor for protection of individual rights. It's not a ceiling. What that means is that states are free to enact laws that protect rights more broadly than the federal Constitution. And when the federal government fails to protect people's rights, then the states have a duty and certainly the power to step in and pass laws that will protect their citizens' rights from federal overreach. This is something that was well known to our founders, and that's why they set up the system of federalism that we have today. And of course, state constitutions already provide broader protections for rights in a variety of different areas, free speech rights, property rights, privacy rights, you name it. And the Supreme Court has recognized that those rights, that states can provide protections for those rights. And in fact, the Supreme Court has also said repeatedly that the regulation of health and safety and the medical profession itself is primarily a matter of local concern. And although federal officials can sometimes override state choices in this area, states have great latitude to legislate to protect in the area of health and, of course, to legislate in the area of medicine. In fact, the FDA has no authority over the practice of medicine. That is a state power, and that is the role of the states. But as the FDA continues to stifle speech and continues to pass rules that govern how doctors and pharmaceutical companies and patients can work together, what they're really doing is having a de facto role in the practice of medicine. So again, this is an area where states can step in and protect their citizens. And in fact, states are already doing so with something called the Free Speech in Medicine Act. The text of the act is actually quite simple. It's a one-page bill, so it's an easy and quick read. This is something that the Goldwater Institute came up with, myself and my colleague Naomi Lopez-Bauman, in a report that we wrote that I mentioned at the beginning of the call. And you can go online onto our website, goldwaterinstitute.org, and find the model legislation there. But it's very simple. It has some definitions and some other things, but at its root, it says that pharmaceutical manufacturers and their representatives may engage in truthful promotion of off-label uses. That's really the operative part of the law. So essentially, states are protecting the rights of doctors, the rights of patients, the rights of medical professionals to receive and share that truthful information about legal medical treatments. That's what the law does. Very simple. Now, the state of Arizona became the first state to adopt that law back in 2017. And something that's interesting for those of you who are interested in the political process, that law was adopted unanimously in the state of Arizona. It was adopted with bipartisan support because, again, this is a bill that helped patients, it helped doctors, it protected free speech, and it's really something that codified what the courts have been trying to tell us, in my opinion, for years, that that it's not appropriate for the FDA to outlaw speech when the underlying conduct is perfectly legal and the speech itself is not misleading. Other states are already following Arizona. Colorado and Missouri have introduced laws already in their legislative sessions this year, and we hear that a handful of other states may be introducing free speech and medicine laws as well. Now, what does this mean for the future of medicine and off-label promotion? Well, and it seems to me that a couple of things could happen. You could essentially have a de facto protection for off-label speech if every single state or the majority of the states pass these protections for free speech in medicine. You could have a situation where these state reforms finally drive reform at the federal level. Congress so far has not really been willing or able to address once and for all this issue. And although the FDA every now and then issues draft rules and asks for notice and comment from the public, those rules are typically delayed and don't really get to the root of the problem. So perhaps when states start standing up for this right and it becomes more publicized throughout the country, this might eventually drive reform in Washington. There would certainly be an interest in Congress or the FDA taking up this issue if the states are stepping in to protect these rights, because you would end up with a patchwork system of protection throughout the country, and it would be much better and again, a lot better guidance for the federal government to step in and take care of this in one fell swoop. So we may see that happening in the coming months and years. But another thing we may see is we may see the FDA come in and challenge one of these state laws. And again, the FDA could do that by saying, well, this is a power of the FDA to regulate in this area. The federal law and the FDA's policies conflict with the state law. And in that case, the FDA would claim or could claim that federal law triumphs, that federal law ought to be supreme. And in that case, we would really get the issue would come to a head, right? It wouldn't involve any specific facts necessarily of these companies. We wouldn't be looking at potentials for settlement or changing the facts to moot the question. What we'd be looking at is simply the question of, can the state law prevail? And of course, the state law can prevail if the federal law itself is unconstitutional. The argument, again, being that the First Amendment protects truthful, not misleading speech, and that's exactly what these pharmaceutical representatives are engaging in, and so the FDA's prohibition on off-label speech ought to be struck down. If the state and federal laws came into conflict in that way and were challenged in court, this could finally provide the vehicle that's needed to get this question up to the United States Supreme Court and answer this question once and for all. So I find this to be a very exciting time for free speech in medicine. I think it's encouraging to see that states are taking these steps. I think it's encouraging in a number of ways, and I think that we will see, as a result of what these states are doing, some action at the federal level, whether that be through Congress or through the courts. But with that, I hope that gave you kind of a basic idea of the history of this and what's been going on in this area and why we ought to be concerned about it. And I'd love to take your questions. And of course, if you don't get an opportunity to have your question answered, I encourage you to reach out to me or my colleagues and to visit our website at goldwaterinstitute.org, where you can see our model legislation and you can see the report for more information. So thank you.
Christina, that was awesome. Thank you so much. And as Christina mentioned, we're going to go to audience questions now. In a moment, everyone on the call is going to hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, you enter star and then the pound button on your telephone keypad. I'm going to open the floor now. Okay, the floor mode's on. When we get to your request, you'll hear a prompt, and then you can ask your question. We'll answer the questions in the order in which they're received. Again, if you want to ask a question, just enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad. We have questions already, but I want to make one comment about what Christina presented on, and that is the Howard Root story and Vascular Solutions. Anyone who's been listening to the Free Lunch podcast of the Regulatory Transparency Project since the beginning knows that we did, or that Howard Root was a guest on one of our podcasts, and that's available on our website at regproject.org. A really compelling story, as Christina mentioned, and one that if you're interested in this, you ought to take a look at it and listen to. Christina, we're going to go to the first question.
So when Commissioner Gottlieb was at the American Enterprise Institute, he wrote in favor of expanding and broadening the rules around off-label communication. Can you talk about how that might play into reforms in the future?
Yes, thank you, caller. And again, this is Christina Sandifer at the Goldwater Institute. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about that because although the FDA in the past has not been very helpful or has not given us a lot of hope on this issue, I do think we have some hope in Commissioner Gottlieb. Keep in mind that what we're talking about here is a federal law. It's in statute that misbranding is a crime. But of course, the way that the FDA interprets misbranding is why we have these types of is why we see these people accused of crimes, and why the FDA has been going after pharmaceutical representatives and CEOs and whatnot for speaking the truth about medicine. And so if the FDA were to issue guidelines or rules that were essentially to say, look, it's not misbranding for a pharmaceutical company to share lawful information that is truthful, that isn't misleading, that's about a lawful treatment, that's not misbranding because, again, you're not misleading anybody about the treatment. That would go a long way, and the FDA certainly has the power to do that. And it does seem like Commissioner Gottlieb is interested in taking those steps. There actually was a proposed rule in the last days of the Obama administration that took a couple of steps toward reforming these off-label, this ban on off-label speech, but it didn't go nearly as far as I think Commissioner Gottlieb is hopefully willing to go. And so I think that would do a lot to clear up some of this confusion. However, it would also be great to see Congress take some action here and pass a law to clarify that truthful promotion of off-label uses is not misbranding, because that would outlive any particular administration. Commissioner Gottlieb, even if he's interested in protecting this area of speech, is not going to be in office in perpetuity, and it would be really helpful to have clarified in the law once and for all that this type of speech is protected. Because, again, this chilling effect is very real, and companies have invested, they have investors, and they've put a lot of time and a lot of money into getting these treatments out to market, and they don't want to run afoul of the FDA. And if they know that they're going to be spending millions of dollars and all of this time fighting the FDA, they may be less likely to invest in products and to get these medical innovations out there to market and to talk about them. And so that's why, again, although we welcome the FDA to take steps here, and I think Commissioner Gottlieb will, and I certainly hope he will follow the lead of the states, it would also be really great to see Congress take some action here as well.
Well, thank you, caller, and a big thanks to you, Christina. What a great response. I'd like to make one announcement before we go to our next caller, and that is that I hope everyone on the call will mark your calendars. Next week, the RTP will host two free lunch podcast teleforums. On Tuesday, January 16th, we'll discuss regulatory hurdles for entrepreneurs with Braden Busek of the Beacon Center for Tennessee and Armand Lausanne, a Tennessee entrepreneur who founded Project Bell, an online service that connects consumers directly with health and beauty professionals for in-home and at-work care in Tennessee. And on Wednesday, January 17th, we'll discuss the Department of the Interior's recent regulatory reform actions with Counselor to the Deputy Secretary of DOI, Gary Lawkowski. Okay, we'll go to our next question now.
Hi, listen, thank you very much. This has been extremely informative, and I just really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I have one question, and that is about the area of psychotropic drugs. And it's such a fuzzy area, and there's been so much abuse in that area with off-label promotion. And I just don't, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to balance this because, you know, there's a lot of claims that can be made that aren't technically lies, but, you know, that have led to Abilify, an antipsychotic, becoming a blockbuster drug, the top-selling drug, being marketed and given to children, you know, as an add-on for ADHD medication and depression and, you know, all kinds of things, all kinds of promotion off-label that has led to that. And, I mean, that's a serious drug with some serious adverse effects. So it's just the whole area. I don't know if you can address anything in that of what kind of protections could be in place, because that area of the psychiatric drugs and mental health things is completely fuzzy and open for lots of abuses.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that question. And again, this is Christina Sandifer, the speaker. I think you make a very, very good point. And there are a couple of responses I have to that. One is there's always going to be some fuzziness here, right? Because when you're talking about medicine and you're talking about treatments and medicines are going to work differently in every individual. And so there are some claims that will be based on research that will be true and work well for many individuals that might not work the exact same way for other individuals. And so there's always going to be a fuzzy area where providing information would be truthful and might not even be misleading, but might lead doctors or patients to make decisions that we might believe aren't the right decisions for them to make. Couple of thoughts there. One, of course, at the end of the day, nobody's going to have perfect information. The FDA itself doesn't have perfect information, and we're sort of drawing an arbitrary line when we say that once a treatment has made it through a certain amount of tests and a certain amount of data is out there, then that information is allowed to be disseminated to doctors and insurance companies and even the public. But before that arbitrary line, that information is prohibited from being released. We know that there have been treatments that have been on the market for decades that the FDA has then decided to pull or adjust or send back for additional testing because new things have been learned about those treatments. And so there's always going to be information out there that might not be complete or that might not be perfect. But since nobody has perfect information, the best response, I think, to information asymmetries and those types of problems is getting more information out there, making sure that doctors do have the full information. And if there are concerns about some of the information that's being put out there, never in our history have patients been more informed and have there been more opportunities to be able to crowdsource information or to put information out there on the internet and other places to explain that maybe this information that the pharmaceutical companies is providing isn't telling the whole story. So I think the way that we fight information that may be incomplete is with more information. Now, of course, pharmaceutical companies under these state free speech and medicine laws and under federal law would still be liable if they have duties to inform patients if there are concerns or risks, and they would still have to do that. So even if they're marketing off-label, they would still have to put that information out there or share risks or concerns that adverse data that the company has. So all of those duties would still exist. And, of course, doctors are still using their medical judgment for prescribing these things to patients. None of these laws allow patients to go out there and get these treatments without a doctor's prescription. And, of course, the doctor knows their patient best. So these are all, I think these are all checks on very legitimate concerns about information that might not be perfect. I also, though, want everyone to keep in mind that there's currently a lot of information about treatments, a lot of very unscientific or unconfirmed information that is completely outside of the FDA's regulatory authority altogether. There's a lot of vitamins or homeopathic remedies that are out there that do not have to go through the same types of rigorous scientific testing, and because those treatments are not regulated by the FDA at all, and so all they have to do, all those companies have to do, is slap a little label saying on their products saying that the FDA hasn't regulated or approved these statements, and then they can go out there and market these treatments to the public, claiming that they do all sorts of things that maybe science doesn't actually back up. So if that is already going on and that's allowed to persist, again, I think it's very important that we make sure that there's also information out there that is scientific, that is truthful, and that has been confirmed by the scientific process and scientific studies so that patients are getting all the information they need to be able to make informed decisions.
Another great question and answer. Again, to ask a question, please enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and we'll get to your question in the order that we receive it. We'll go to the next question now.
Thank you. You've been talking about drug makers predominantly, even though Vascular Solutions was a device company, the state legislation proposed bills, would they do the same thing for device makers as well as drug makers, allowing them to share off-label information?
Thanks for the opportunity to clarify that. This is Christina Sandifer. And the short answer is yes. The state laws, or at least the model legislation, applies not just to drugs, but other treatments and devices as well, including the type of device that Vascular Solutions was marketing. Now, of course, every single state can do what they wish with the model legislation, and so there may be states that would prefer to limit that protection only to drugs or to smaller markets, but the model legislation contemplates this information being shared for any kind of treatment, whether it be a drug or a device. I don't see any principled reason for drawing a distinction between the two, although lawmakers may choose to do so.
Wonderful. Thank you. We'll go to our next question now. If you have a question, just enter star and then pound on your telephone keypad, and I think we may have time to get to at least another, but we'll go to our next question now.
Hi. I have a question about this proposed legislation. Is there a concern that if this off-label policy, communication policy goes into effect, that drug companies wouldn't have the incentive to do rigorous trials and studies of their drugs?
Thank you for that question about drug company incentives, and this is Christina Sandifer responding. I don't think that that is a concern. Again, the question was about whether drug companies wouldn't have an incentive to go through rigorous studies for their drugs, because the law is drawn very narrowly to only apply to scientific information, truthful information, information that is not misleading. These are terms of art in the legal community and have been defined as information that is, again, backed up by scientific study and fact. So we're not looking at a situation where drug companies that were previously prohibited from sharing information can now just go out and put out whatever kinds of claims that they feel like, whether they're backed up by science or not. Certainly that is not the situation that the model law promotes. Instead, the model law allows companies to share information that is backed by science, that is the product of rigorous study. And so you have a situation where you're just getting more scientific information out there and not less. Companies already have to go through pretty rigorous testing just to get their drug initially approved, and the FDA itself recognizes that companies need not go through that process every single time that treatment, drug or device or otherwise, is going to be used in a different, illness or a different patient population or in a different dosage. That would be cost prohibitive, and the FDA recognizes that. That's why they allow off-label use to begin with. I think really we ought to be concerned about allowing those types of treatments to occur without doctors or patients having the full information. So the FDA recognizes that these treatments have already been through rigorous scientific testing, and doctors ought to be allowed to make some adjustments for patients that might not fit perfectly within what that treatment was approved for. But if the doctors don't have the full information they need or the most up-to-date information they need to be able to treat that way, then the concern isn't so much about the companies not having the incentive to put the information about their or to make sure the information is truthful, but the doctors sort of shooting in the dark and recommending treatments without full information on how those treatments should be provided, and again without patients having the full information that they need to be able to make the decisions. But I do want to say that all of these questions are pointing to one legitimate point that we should never forget, that there are bad actors out there, right? Pharmaceutical companies sometimes do bad things. Sometimes they provide information that isn't good. That's certainly always going to be the case. There are always bad actors out there. But we don't want to craft rules that are going to create a blanket gag effect for everybody out there that's going to harm doctors and patients simply to stop a couple of bad actors. Instead, what we should do is presume in favor of speech. We should presume that more information, especially when it's truthful, not misleading information, is a good thing. And then we should go after the individuals who are bad actors, because of course companies that put information out there that is misleading or isn't truthful, or they are being deceptive, those companies are engaging in fraud and they ought to be prosecuted to the full extent of the law.
Wonderful question and great answer again, Christina. I think as a part of the Regulatory Transparency Project, one of the things we do is we run focus groups around the country, and this is something that people are very much concerned about, right? The health and safety of what they eat, what they drink, and the medications that they take. And so I really appreciate that question from the caller, but I think that was a, you know, an answer that I think is compelling, and I think people can understand. I don't see any more questions, Christina, and we're running up close to our end for our one-hour call. Are there any final remarks you'd like to make, anything that didn't come up that you'd like to cover before we end our call today?
Well, I think what's important, again, to keep in mind is that at the end of the day, there's all sorts of information out there, and more information is better. But at the end of the day, it really comes down to an individual's decision, right? The decision of the patient and what treatments they want to try and what risks they want to take, the decision of the doctor to be able to treat his or her patient to the fullest extent of his or her training. And I think that we ought to be looking at federal laws and state laws that, of course, protect people from bad actors, from fraudulent actors, from true harm, but that allow for the greatest dissemination of information so that people are empowered to be able to make choices. Back when the FDA was first formed, it was supposed to be an agency that was to ensure that treatments were safe and that patients were empowered with the most information out there so that they could make decisions. And now what we see, and again, I think the intentions were good here, but what we see is an agency that is increasingly substituting its own judgment, the judgment of bureaucrats in Washington, D.C., for the judgment of patients and doctors. And that really is not good for anybody, and that's not something that the Constitution allows. So I think by protecting free speech in medicine, we're really helping patients and doctors find their way toward better treatments, which is going to empower patients, protect medical autonomy, and allow people to make better decisions about really the most important questions they'll ever have to answer, their health. So thanks so much for having me, and thanks to everybody on the call for joining us.
Outstanding closing remarks, Christina, and thank you so much for being our guest today on the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project Free Lunch Podcast. On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, I also want to thank our audience for joining. I hope that you'll join us again next week for our two teleforums. But until then, so long.
On behalf of the Federalist Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to Free Lunch. As always, you can subscribe on iTunes and Google Play to get new episodes of Free Lunch when they're published. Also, visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org. There, we regularly upload content in addition to our podcasts, such as short videos and papers. And you can join the discussion by sharing your story of how regulation has personally affected you. Until next time, remember, there's no such thing as a free lunch.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.